Hello everyone, welcome back to Sabbath School from Home. So glad you could join us. My name is Cameron.
Yeah, g'day, I'm Ken.
And I'm Lachlan.
We've managed some short introductions, which is just as well because the psalm we're looking at today is a long psalm. So I propose we launch straight into it to maximise our discussion time. The general banner this comes under is the psalms as an instrument by which the lessons of the past are preserved. So lessons from the past. And we've decided to flick to Psalm 78, and it is a long psalm, so we won't read it all. But we shall read the start of it, at least, and have a discussion and see if we can't make our way to the end in a timely fashion. Locke, do you want to kick us off?
All right. O my people, listen to my instructions. Open your ears to what I am saying, for I will speak to you in a parable. I will teach you hidden lessons from our past, stories we have heard and known, stories our ancestors handed down to us. We will not hide these truths from our children. We will tell the next generation about the glorious deeds of the Lord, about his power and his mighty wonders.
He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands. They would not be like their forefathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation whose hearts were not loyal to God, whose spirits were not faithful to him.
Well, let's pause there before we kick on. Thoughts that come to mind?
Look, I've been reading a book recently called The Memory Code by, I think, Lynn Kelly. Basically, it's looking at the ways that oral tradition transmits and remembers information. Of course, we live in a literate society where things are written. In fact, we live, I think, in a post-literate society where things are not just recorded in books, but there's an astonishing amount of information, all the knowledge of the world available in the palms of our hand.
It's also, Ken, post-literate in the sense that we have abandoned phonetic language and adopted hieroglyphics again in the form of emoji.
Well, quite so. And I have to say, emojis never cease to confuse me because there seem to be multiple emojis that, to my mind, contain the same expression and the same meaning, and I can't distinguish between them. But I love them nonetheless. My wife is the emoji queen. She's a wonderful emoji user. In any event, getting back to this book called The Memory Code, Lynn points out that in oral cultures, there is still a need for a vast amount of information to be available, and that these cultures need a way of storing that information. And there are basically three ways that that's done. The first is location, the second is song, and the third is story. I'm not sure that they're the distinctions that she would make, but that's what I've drawn from it. And so we have the indigenous song lines, and we have the important cultural places that, and often her thesis is these methods were used to accurately transmit information, which is why there would often need to be initiations, and that the information wasn't promulgated widely because it needed to be maintained accurately and to avoid errors creeping in with wide dissemination. All of which seems to me to be quite sensible, and that there was really encyclopedic knowledge. She gives examples of knowledge that was able to be called on by elders to deal with a drought which hadn't been experienced for hundreds of years, but the information was still available. And the more shocking the story, the more likely the information encoded in it is going to be remembered. And one of the things that is also important, as I said earlier, was location. Her thesis is that, in fact, Stonehenge was a memory tool which used location to with a culture that was transitioning from nomadic to being more settled, so that visiting the different places that might contain the information wasn't as regular or as easy. All of which is to say, it occurred to me that many of the things that she speaks about seem to be present in the what was, of course, the largely oral tradition of the ancient Israel, even through to the time of Christ, although there was certainly literacy. Christ himself spoke in parables, memorable stories, which is what we're told here. I'll open my mouth in parables. And you will remember when the Israelites crossed the Jordan, and the instruction that I suspect is what's being spoken about here in about verse 4, will not hide them from the children, will tell the next generation, and which he commanded our forefathers to teach the children in verse 5. We've got the rocks out of the river and put them and built a memorial, and we built that so that you can tell your children about these things that God has done. It seems to me that what's being spoken about here are those very concrete and practical ways of remembering really important information.
Yeah, I mean, your observation kind of Stonehenge being potentially crafted by a culture transitioning from nomadic to more located way of living is very similar to the transition that takes place in the Old Testament among the people of Israel and the culture that the Old Testament focuses on. And in some ways, the sanctuary and temple, tabernacle and temple, are aligned with this transition to a grounded, more permanent geographic existence, away from the nomadic existence where one would make altars out of stones that they'd used as pillows.
And we've commented in other seasons, I'm thinking particularly the season we did discussing the covenant, the fact that in the early books of the Bible, the people recording the narrative are very down on cities and very up on nomadic life. Hmm. So you have Cain, I think, built a city. You have Babel as the city. You have Lot, who chose the city. You have, and the city is nearly always in the, I'm trying to think, is it in the east or is it in the west? It's always in a particular direction. I remember there was a sort of geographic pattern we picked up at the time, but it's not anticipating our conversation to go in this direction. I haven't gone back and prepared thoughts on that topic. I will say that there's a great episode of Man Lab, which is a fun, lighthearted project. It's a BBC TV series by James May, and it's just talking about the loss of skills, everyday normal handyman skills, but they're presented in very lighthearted means. So when he's lamenting the loss of navigation, he adopts as an exercise escaping Dartmoor prison with the aid of a map, and he explains the principles of navigation while they're evading some professional trackers, and it's done in a highly humorous way. But one of the things he does is he gets challenged to it's on the line of memories. You know, we don't remember much these days. I can remember my parents' phone number from a child, but I can't remember any of my friends' phone numbers now because I never had to memorize them. And so he adopts as a challenge the task of being one of two commentators for a horse race, where you are expected to recognize from the jockey's colors the horse's name and the trainer and the jockey. And One of the things he does is he gets a professional commentator to come and help him. And he says, all right, well, you know, this colour's red and white. Let's go out into your garden. Can you see anything red and white? All right, well, let's wander over there. And they wander over and now look at the jockey's name. Is there anything about the jockey's name that, can you draw any connection at all between the jockey's name and this thing that's in your garden that's red and white? And they play this game, and in the end, some of them are rhymes and some of them are reminiscences, and, you know, it's really remote. Like, I'm making this up now, I can't remember, but it's something like, oh, yeah, but that came from my parents' place, and their neighbour was called Mr. Jenkins. And the jockey's name is Benkins or something. All right, well, that's a connection, you know, and it's these sort of quite what seem to be obtuse connections. But then James May practices in preparing for his horse race by walking around the garden. And then the man says, all right, but now you have to walk around in a different order. Because when you memorize something in a certain order, it's like trying to remember the fifth digit of your phone number. You know it if you go through it in order. But with a horse race, they might come in any order. I mean, that is the point of the race. So then he tests James May.
Well, if it's a fair race.
It's a fair race. Yeah. But what you were describing, Ken, is exactly what this sort of expert who professionally has to memorize fairly obtuse information or non-apparent or obvious information.
Well, and it's what these memory champions use as well. They create imaginary spaces, and then they attach the things that they have to remember to various objects in those imaginary spaces. So it's a very well-known memory device. In fact, its location is the memory device of choice.
Yeah. Here, I have an anecdote about this. It's just come to me. I was driving home from work today, and I had been listening to an audiobook on my commute into work, and something glitched, and the audiobook must have kept playing on my phone all day while I was at work with the volume set to zero, and I couldn't obviously hear anything. And when I got back to my car, I thought, I don't think this sounds like I'm in the right part of the book. So then I had to try and work out where had I gotten up to. This is an interesting one because there's nothing tangible, nothing physical. With a physical book, you could be like, I felt like my left hand was holding, you know, half the book or a third of the book. No, nothing tangible whatsoever. A digital audio book that I was listening to. So I skipped back to a chapter name that I recognized and thought that was it. And then when I started to listen to it, I realized, no, I definitely heard that this morning because I remember driving past and I remember driving up a hill. I was listening to that bit while I was driving up a hill. So I skipped forward 2 minutes. No, I definitely heard this because when I was hearing this morning, I was coming up the ramp into the university car park. And it was the spatial association of the short-term memory of having just 8 hours earlier, been listening to those parts of the story. They were tied to where I had been driving. Isn't that remarkable? Well, I'd forgotten about it until now. It's highlighting exactly the effect we're discussing.
An extra anecdote. Yours has brought to mind, Locke, and that is that our chaplain, and Clancy would be able to help us more on this one. We need to have Clancy back on this podcast, Locke. It's been quite a while. But the concept of a labyrinth laid into medieval churches or churchyards or fields. And a labyrinth is effectively a maze but without any choices. So it's a long convoluted path that twists and snakes about the place. And these have been a feature of Christian expressions of faith for a long time, particularly if you were too poor to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land or to wherever else you might be expected to go as a Middle Ages Christian. But if you're a peasant, you can't go to the Holy Lands. You're too busy trying to feed yourself. But there might be a labyrinth laid into the floor of the church or a path to follow. And it might take you past a statue of this saint or a glass window depicting this. As you walk through the journey, you remember those things. And our chaplain at grammar, when I was teaching there, drew one out in chalk And he said, when you get to each of these points on the labyrinth, stop, and I've left a little piece of paper on the ground. Think of something you're grateful for, or one of them might be, is anyone I need to apologize to? Or, you know, just stop and think about it as you walk past. Mm. It was a great experience. And I've mowed a labyrinth into my lawn. It's about 2 kilometers long, and it snakes across my lawn, and it's a one long continuous path, and it means I can go for a good half hour's walk without being too far from the house. And there have been times where I've walked it and prayed, and as you're talking, I can think of specific prayers I've prayed at specific points on the labyrinth.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? My immediate response to that is that I think our Adventist tradition has at times shied away from this sort of thing for fear that it might be connected to idolatry. But that is obviously making an unjustified leap too far, because it seems that what we're describing here is just inescapably part of the way the human mind...
Can I address the idolatry thing, Locke? You shall not make any graven image, is apparently the commandment. And yet, you know, our missionaries use picture scrolls. And I'm failing to see how the three-dimensionalness of the statue makes it so wholeheartedly evil. Idolatry is like such a first and foremost primary sort of sin. Mm. But, you know, pictures in kids' storybooks or on missionary scrolls are all okay. And one wonders if at least some of the statues in some of the old Catholic churches were there to serve the same purpose as the picture scrolls.
Yeah. Yeah, one does wonder. Statues are an interesting one. Here's a thought. As you walk around, you're both located in Launceston. I think there are statues probably in parks and public squares in Launceston. There are not very many statues in the wonderful town of Currumbong. But if I drive to Sydney or even go into Newcastle, there are statues of kings, statues of explorers. My observation is simply this. Are we in the post-statue era of society? Do we erect statues anymore?
We erect blue plaques on this spot in 1926. You know, it's Ernest Shackleton drank a pint of bitter or something, you know, and then it's put there on a blue sign. And I remember seeing one on a park bench, a picture of one that went something like, on this spot in 2006, John Henry's realised that anyone can buy a blue plaque if they have enough money.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. No, I mean, the reason that I raise it is it's just interesting because one thing we need to address before we run out of time on this podcast is what memories are we currently preserving? It's fairly clear, you know, as this psalm continues, and we don't have time to read all the verses, it continues by, it seems to me, scanning it, giving an account. A shortened account, and probably at times a bit of an interpretive account for emphasis, of the history of the audience, the history of the people of Israel.
That's exactly what has been done. He talks about them going through the Red Sea. He talks about them demanding the food. He talks about the rock being struck. He talks about the manna. He talks about all of these wonders. He talks about various battles. So he gives this history. And what you have to remember, which brings home this point further, the psalm is a song.
Yeah.
Yes. I had thought that, actually. It's interesting in its connection.
Can I just pause something in there? Ken, in your summary of the events it describes, I was reading the psalm to try and pick out the verses and I missed some of what you said. Did you draw attention to the fact that in every instance where a narrative is given, the psalmist stresses the fact that the people of Israel sinned and did not obey God?
I didn't point that out, but that is a clear point that seems to come through in all of those stories, and I suspect might well be in all of the stories that he tells, at least until the very end. And we'll come back to that in a minute.
Well, this is another cultural element that we are a little separate from. I can't imagine us singing a song in an Adventist church that describes all the things we've done wrong. As far as I can tell, there doesn't seem to be an acknowledgement of us having done anything wrong at all. And partly this is because our church grew up in America, I think. And maybe I'm buying into a stereotype and you can shoot me down in flames soon, but hear me out. Robert Llewellyn, a British comedian, describes once having dinner at an American, he worked in California for a good number of years, and he was at some dinner party and someone asked him what he did. And a lady next to him asked him what he did. And he said, oh, I'm a comedian. Oh, she said, well, how's your comedy? How is it going? And he said, oh, terrible, because he's British. And the lady was really upset. She said, like, oh, no, is there anything you could do? Like, is there anyone you can talk to? And it hadn't been going so bad as all that. But, you know, it was just the British way of talking about it. And so the next time he was out at dinner and someone asked him what he did, he said, well, actually, I'm one of Britain's leading young comedians. And he said, I said it with my heart in my mouth, thinking they're going to call me out on this because, oh, that's great. That's great. So there's a between those two, that's the stereotype I think illustrated between the British and the Americans, is that one is sort of compulsively self-effacing. And the way you can tell if someone is British, apparently, according to Henning Vane, is to creep up behind them in a supermarket and then with sudden force ram your shopping trolley into the back of their heels. And if the person turns around and apologises to you, then they're British. So, then you have the American stereotype, which is everything's great and awesome, and it's not as if there is really that much of a strong moral dimension in this. One suspects, given all the history of colonialism and abuses perpetrated by the British over a large number of times, that their self-effacement, it's possibly not quite as sincere necessarily as you think anyway. So it's not that I'm saying that, the American mindset is inherently more wrong than the British self-effacing mindset. Although I think it lends itself more easily to casual indifference to our own failings, to be all gung-ho about how good we are. And that sort of stamp is on the Adventist church.
It's interesting because, I don't know, I'm just looking at verse 32, which is one instance of what you're describing in this psalm camp. But in spite of this, the people kept sinning. Yeah. Despite God's wonders, they refused to trust him. I think our Adventist church culture is a little bit more comfortable with accepting individual sinfulness. We are more than happy to sing a hymn that refers to our individual sinfulness, but we're very, very reluctant to do anything, to engage in any way that might be discussing a corporate failing, a collective failing, an institutional failing and falling short. That's a fascinating little aspect.
The stress very much here is, so reading on from the verse you quoted, which was 32, so God makes their days vanish like a breath and their years in terror, and when he killed them, they sought him, which is something that we could discuss. They repented and sought God earnestly. They remembered that God was their rock, the Most High was their redeemer. But they flattered him with their mouths and they lied to him with their tongues. Their heart was not steadfast towards him. They were not faithful to his covenant, even though that they've redeemed. Yet he, being compassionate, atoned for their iniquity. So the psalmist is saying, even when we repented, we didn't do it very well.
Yeah.
We really didn't mean it, but he was merciful and forgave their iniquities and did not destroy them. Time after time he restrained his anger and did not stir up his full wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh, a passing breeze that does not return. Oh, there's wonderful comfort in that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an aspect here that is puzzling me in the opening verses that we read. In verse 2 and then verse 4. Because verse 2, leading into this exploration of their history, and really it's not an exploration of their history, it's using their history, their shared and known history, as a parable through which to explore God's grace and mercy. That seems to me what's emerging. But in verse 2, "For I will speak to you in a parable, I will teach you hidden lessons from our past." I'm puzzled by that word hidden, because it continues, "hidden lessons from our past, stories we have heard and known, stories our ancestors handed down to us." In what sense is this hidden? And then in verse 4, it gets on to say, "we will not hide these truths from our children." So I'm puzzled here by a juxtaposition of a sense of hiddenness and a sense of commonality and universal cultural awareness.
Yeah. I'm just going to the Hebrew Bible by Robert Alter. His translation of verse 2 is, "Let me open my mouth in a rhapsody. Let me voice the verses of old that we have heard and we have known and that our fathers recounted to us." And it may well be, I mean, if you think about those, some of those cultural things about the transmission of information, it may be that while the stories are told, they remain the province of a limited number to tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, they may not be hidden, but they may not be... that their accuracy may be tightly controlled.
There's a sense in which...
Anyway, it is an interesting thought.
There's a sense in which the message of this psalm is hidden from us just by our natural conceit. I mean, one of the central messages of this psalm is that God is faithful. And above and beyond what would be warranted by our faithfulness, which is not very much. We're pretty much next to useless. So maybe there's a sense in which, you know, I'm going to say something that's hidden from you.
It may be hidden in the sense that you're unable to see it, rather than in the sense that it's not obvious.
Yeah. It might be obvious to everyone else. C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis talks about. He writes an essay on the trouble with X, the trouble with person X. He said we all have a person X in our life, and they go, "Oh, the trouble with that person is they just." And you know, it's that person who flips us easier than anyone else, and we lose temper with their irritating and frustrating and what must be deliberately obtuse and vindictive habits or whatever it is. It's that person, or if you're a teacher, it's that student. And Lewis makes the point, he said, that you can't pray to God about this situation as if you're informing him or as if it is a new experience for God. God's had to put up with a fair number of people that do irritating things, and God can see all the person X's, except there's one extra person X that he can see that you can't. Which is you.
Oh, that's very good. I don't know what more of this psalm we would want to and the other thoughts that might come out of our discussion in it, but if we were looking at coming towards an end, there are two further things that I think I would like to draw attention to. And one is how the psalm finishes. And we go to verse 65. "Then the Lord awoke as from sleep as a man wakes from the stupor of wine. He beat back his enemies, he put them to everlasting shame. Then he rejected the tents of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah. Mount Zion, which he loved, he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth that he established forever. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheep pens, from tending the sheep. He brought him to be the shepherd of his people Jacob, of Israel his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart. With skillful hands he led them. I want to remind you of the description of Daniel as a leader. It's put in the negative. He was, but I'll put them in the positive. He had integrity, and he was competent. And we see the same thing said about David here. He has integrity, and he's competent.
Except that I think Daniel had more integrity and was more competent.
All right. Well, I'm not going to go into the comparisons. Yes. But they're the ideal characteristics of somebody that you want leading. Somebody with integrity of heart and somebody with skill. So they're competence. I thought that was interesting. That's the first thing I would like to I'd like to say. And if there's any other reflections on passage or those observations.
I had a reflection on the ending, Kent. To me, it actually feels like a startlingly abrupt ending to a long psalm. Startlingly abrupt in the sense that it doesn't hammer home a sort of a church sermon or a church children's story overly moralized point at the end of it. You know, David cared God made David the shepherd of Jacob's descendants. David cared for them competently and kindly, and that's what God does too. God cares for us competently. You know, it doesn't have that ending. And I don't really know what to make of it, if anything. I just think it feels abrupt. It feels startling. And maybe by leaving it feeling abrupt and startling, it leaves you cogitating and reflecting. It doesn't tie off too neatly so that you sort of switch off and say, that was wonderful, and go away and don't think about it anymore. Possibly it has that effect.
This was written. You know, was it written for the funeral service for David? Because it glosses over a few episodes of his life that weren't quite so skillful. One also wonders if it was written, say, during the reign of Solomon or later in David's life, whether the Psalms would have finished it the same way, seeing that the huge amount of chaos that the nation of Israel descended into within two generations, and some pretty lawless kings who became a byword for exactly what this psalm is describing, which is the people falling away.
So it's what it does is it says this has been our history.
Yeah.
This is where we are now. What does the future hold?
Yeah.
And that's perhaps a good thing for us to reflect on. The second point then was these memory devices that we use, this remembering, what is it that we need to remember? Well, we need to remember the important things. For hunter-gatherers, we need to know that at this time of year, these sort of animals are going to be available in this place. We need to know that those sort of plants are poisonous in these situations, but in a disaster prepared this way, they can provide some nourishment sufficient to sustain you to get through it. They're some of the sorts of things that might be important information. I then reflect and say, well, what is the most important information that we can remember? And surely it is, as this psalmist points out, seeing God's action, seeing God's presence, being alive to where he's worked, and even more to his characteristics as a merciful God. To do those things, we need more than just information. We need to see, as Frederick Buechner points out in my favourite sermon, and you can look it up, Frederick Buechner at St John's, I think, Episcopal Church, and the sermon title is Seeing with the Eyes of the Heart. There is so much where we cannot believe. It's so easy in a world where the material is ubiquitous to see nothing beyond it. But when we see beauty, when we see the treasure of a child or a grandchild, when we see love, when we see mercy, these are things that we see with the eye of the heart. And these are the things that the psalmist is reminding us of.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in on this discussion. It stimulated a lot of thought in me, and I hope it has in you. And you can share any thoughts with us, if so you wish, at the email address sabbathschoolfromhome@gmail.com. And you can also, if you so wish, share this podcast with any friends or indeed any enemies that you feel would benefit. And thank you for tuning in, and join us again next week.